Paul C. Cordera, Deputy Public Defender, Public Counsel, David M. Huberman, Assistant Attorney General, Appellate Counsel.
You may proceed.
Good day. May it please the court, my name is Keith Regarrett. I represent Daniel McGinnis. And I'm here today because with the stroke of the pen, the Court of Appeals has divested thousands of indigent defendants of rights that were previously unchallenged in this state. In the state of Virginia, a defendant has always had the ability to file a motion to attempt to replace or fire their attorney. And in the state of Virginia, a defendant has always had the ability to file a motion to reconsider if their attorney did not make the proper arguments during the case as to the sufficiency of the evidence or to preserve their case for appeal.
And I don't disagree with you about the practice. Have we ever addressed expressly, you know, does the court have a discretion? Must the court consider it? Because I was looking at persuasive authority, federal court, state court, and they're all over the map.
Yes, Sean.
Is there a case that polices that boundary of when the court should look at a pro se submission beyond what the attorney is saying?
I can find no case that would specifically stand for that proposition. I think our overall jurisprudence on due process controls in that situation. The most simple way to think about it is that we appoint an indigent defendant an attorney to give him more protections, not less. And so if we use the appointment of an attorney to somehow curtail the ability of a defendant to preserve his own rights, then I think what we've actually done is given him less protection rather than more.
But that can't possibly be right, because if you're in a trial and the attorney that's appointed by and paid for by the state for the defendant is arguing and the pro se pops up and says, I want to take this argument over, the proper response is sit down or you'll be held in contempt. There's no due process issue whatsoever.
I 100% agree with Your Honor. But the case law, as it regards this matter, is on that point, has always been very specific to the trial itself. And the only case on this specifically in Virginia is the Spencer case, which specifically talks about the defendant does not have a right to participate in trial as co-defendant. It did not even prohibit the possibility. It just ruled that there is no right to do so.
So you have a due process right to file a pleading, but you're in court looking at the judge and you do not have a due process right to stand up and say something.
Well, the circumstances, I believe, are wholly different, because often you're dealing with a jury, and you're dealing with a jury, that type of activity could confuse a jury, it could create problems. I would argue that there's no possibility that a judge is going to be confused because the client files the motion to fire the attorney rather than the attorney. And I would argue that there's no possibility that the trial court will be befuddled if it hears a motion to set aside not signed only by the client, the defendant, and not the attorney. And I would argue that there is no chance that this court would be unable to deal with an appeal that was started by a notice of appeal signed only by a defendant.
But I don't know that you need to swing for the fences on that point, because isn't it sufficient? I mean, as opposed to a broad categorical, you have to allow this. If the defendant takes a step and the court considers it, one, it satisfies preservation, and perhaps there's a discretionary component that, well, look, you're just obstreperous, whatever, I'm not going to consider it. But here, the court did and ruled on it, and that's enough.
Just as a call, I would completely agree. I addressed it just to remind the court of the, I think, incredible magnitude of the decision in the case today. It's not as normally is the case with my cases, whether one of my clients is their conviction upheld or not. I think it has broad consequences.
Then why should we address it at all? Because if we went to the sufficiency issue, the very thing he raised, the very thing that the court denied in his motion to reconsider, where are you? I mean, is there any reason to get into all of the who shot John that precedes it?
I think on one out of the three sufficiency issues, I don't think there's much question that under this current law in the state of Virginia that the check was given for a past debt, at which point it's not the crime of larceny for which he was convicted. I think reasonable minds could possibly disagree on the dates and the timing of the first two, but the third check was given months after the services and items were rendered. That makes it a past debt under present Virginia law. And I think just returning to Justice McCullough's point, I think the most important thing that we're here to talk about and what was granted on appeal is whether this issue was preserved under 5A18 under the Court of Appeals' rules of procedure. And in this case, there is no question that the issue was raised by the defendant, and there is no question it was considered by the judge, and that there's no question that he ruled on the issue. And I would argue that even if you were to look at Section 8.01...
I agree with all that. I agree with all that. All right, but the issue before us is that the Court of Appeals, that also agreed with all that and knew it all that happened, says I have no choice. 8.01-271.1 says every pleading, written motion, and other paper of a party represented by an attorney shall be signed by at least one attorney of record in his individual name. Now, the problem is that if you were making this argument on a blank slate and saying, you know, the court ought to adopt a rule on this that says this is okay, and there wasn't a statute, that'd be great. I'd probably agree with every bit of it. I'd get out my paper and start drafting the rule. But we have a statute where the General Assembly says, this is not going to be a hybrid case here in Virginia. You've got a lawyer, you work through the lawyer.
We aren't.
Go ahead.
I agree from that point of view, but I think we have to look at the rest of the statute. And the statute says that it will be stricken only if the attorney does not sign it promptly after it's brought to his attention. I don't think you can bring the penalty but deny the remedy. In this case, as it was brought to the attorney's attention, an attempt was made to sign, and that was not allowed.
Right.
And
now
I would argue at that point...
That's your best argument, not the one we've been talking about. So why don't you pursue
it's
that?
It's a better argument, but following up on what the Chief said with regard to the statute, it says if the pleading is not signed, but this pleading was signed, it just wasn't signed by the attorney. So address that in your comments as well.
I think that when we're talking about whether it's signed, I think it's important that it is signed. And we can look further and all the notice to the Commonwealth was properly done and everything like that. And I think that's important, especially when we're talking about defendants' rights who are at liberty. And I think it would not be an unfair stretch to say it's been signed, it was accepted by the court, and since there was no objection from the Commonwealth at any point where the defendant could go ahead and take advantage of the remedy, that it becomes the law of the case in this case specifically. Because otherwise, we have a judge's order which is completely done on his own, and we're nullifying that as well. And I would argue that the court has the ability at any time to consider an issue, enter an order as to what it has found on this issue. And
well,
I
can't
explain
that to you this. Do you think that statute applies to criminal cases as well as civil cases?
Your Honor, I do not. I believe that is a civil case. I think the fact that it uses the words pleadings are important. We do not normally refer to motions and other things in the criminal context as pleadings, certainly not notices of appeals.
And the Court of Appeals use civil cases. Is that correct?
All of the cases quoted by both the Commonwealth and the Court of Appeals are civil cases. This case has never been applied to deny a criminal defendant of any motion or anything that has ever been filed. It's only been applied in civil. When we think of it, we protect in this country life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And I would argue that happiness deals with civil cases and property. We first protect life and liberty, which is what is at stake in Mr. McGinnis's. And so he has to have a higher level of protection, a higher level of due process, and unless we specifically have a criminal procedure rule that takes this away from him, I would argue it would be improper to apply to the civil statute.
So all right, well, now hold on. But you said 8.01-271 only applies to civil cases.
Your Honor, that would be our position.
Well, it can't be, because we sanction people under 8.01-271 in criminal cases. Now, if what you're saying is that this portion of it is unconstitutional and can't be enforced for due process reasons, that's another matter altogether. But to suggest that 8.01-271 doesn't apply to criminal cases is just wrong, because we do it all the time.
I would argue the only cases it's been applied to criminally are sanction cases, which are, you know, which are disciplinary proceedings against attorneys and don't have all of the due process implications. So I would argue that if the civil statute was going to be done in a way where it did, that certainly that would be violative of due process, and I think we've put that forth on
now brief. That's a better argument, as is the idea that the real issue in this case on the procedure is why didn't the trial court accept the signature that was provided after the fact? Can you address that?
I think that I don't know why it was not. The reason I believe it was not accepted was ones of the record had just moved on at that point. And I think it was the determination was it's just impossible to do that at that point. And that's why I think it's important that we can't, you know, force a defendant to take the penalty without also giving him the opportunity to do the remedy. And I think there's no question that the attorney in this case, once notified, did everything that was within his power to comply with the statute. And the fact that it was not accepted by either the circuit court or the court of appeals, we've assigned error to that, and I believe that that's important. Because
can the circuit court have an order of pleading to be amended or allow a pleading to be amended once the record is in the CAB as opposed to sending something that perhaps wasn't sent before? Short of a clerical error, what authority would give the circuit court the ability to do that?
Well, I would argue two things. One, I think you could consider it a clerical error that it was not signed by the attorney. But more importantly, I think if there's going to be a deadline, the deadline has to go both ways. If it's too late to sign, it's too late to stricken. And I think that is a due process. That comports with due process. If we're going to stricken, it can't be too late to sign. And if it's too late to sign, it's too late to stricken.
But
because you can't have it both. I would argue due process does not allow it to go both ways.
The circuit court record certified by the circuit court clerk at the time of the appeal. It's literally certified. It's an oath. This is the record. That's what the court of appeals got. You can't change that unless the appellate court permits it with a writ of certiorari. It was never requested, never ordered. And that requires a lot of analysis, including whether or not it's clerical. It would hardly be here, but nonetheless. So it is a default position that the record cannot be changed by anyone, particularly the trial court, after it's been certified to the higher court. The lower court's lost all jurisdiction.
But our argument would be, in that case, that if the remedy is now unavailable to the defendant, then the penalty is also available. Either the statute is available in its totality, we would argue, or not at all to the defendant. And if it's not available to sign, it's no longer available to stricken. Because if you don't preserve the entirety of the statute being relevant in this case, then just arbitrarily and capriciously using parts of the statute to remove my client's appeal is certainly violated of due process.
And wouldn't it be no different from someone saying, look, I filed a complaint and the demurrer kicked it out, but I want to amend it, and I just figured out how to amend it on appeal, and you all are being unfair to me for not letting me do that.
Well, I think that's why this statute is best looked at as a civil statute. All of the things Your Honor has addressed it are all specific to civil law as opposed to criminal.
So a motion to reconsider is not a pleading in a criminal case. A motion in limine that's written is not a pleading in a criminal case.
Certainly not in the way that it is in a civil case.
Well, is it in a criminal case? It's not.
We would argue no, that that's not a pleading.
What authority has ever been cited for that proposition, that the word pleading does not apply to pleadings in criminal cases?
I cannot give Your Honor one. I'm also unaware of any authority that stands for the exact opposite.
Because it's so obvious. Of course it's a pleading.
Yes, Your Honor. If I could reserve my remaining time, of course.
All right.
May it please the Court, David Uberman on behalf of the Commonwealth.
Counsel, does the record reflect why this motion to reconsider was not signed by the trial lawyer?
By the trial counsel, Your Honor?
Uh-huh.
No, it does not, Your Honor. The motion's included, and I believe it was filed on the 20th day after the final order was entered.
Well, what would you have the pro se defendant do if, for whatever reason, his trial lawyer didn't get around to signing it?
I suppose the main option, Your Honor, is to file a motion to withdraw, asking counsel to withdraw.
Well,
if it's
happening on the 21st day, the trial court has jurisdiction. Are you suggesting that he'd have to file some kind of motion to fire his lawyer, get another lawyer to file the motion he wanted? on one day?
Your Honor suggested yes. That's what the Court of Appeals cases, at least, have said. In the Key and Chilton, those cases, which were cited in the opinion, the published opinion below, state that in the rare instance where a non-represented party's pleading, who is not proceeding pro se, is considered in the trial court, is when it is contemporaneously filed with a motion seeking to have counsel replaced, and under those circumstances, the court would consider it. Now, in this case, I don't know why the defendant waited until the 20th day to file this motion, but he did, and while he made some general complaints about counsel's effectiveness in the motion to set aside, it was certainly nothing rising to an actual motion to have counsel withdrawn, nor were the disagreements he noted with counsel's performance such that would rise to the level.
Suppose his trial lawyer had said, "Oh, I'm going to file that," and then the trial lawyer got sick, took a vacation, or forgot about the motion. Would the pro se defendant then just be what?
Well, Your Honor, under the current scheme, work with the current statutes and the rules, I think the remedy may lie in the habeas petition.
And collateral. What? I can't hear you.
I believe the remedy may lie in a habeas petition on collateral review. I don't know that there's anything that...
Let me follow up with what Justice Kuntz is asking here. Let's make it a little dicier. I mean, we have a death row inmate, and it's the day. Are you telling me that this statute would pass constitutional muster by saying, "I'm sorry, accused, condemned, we can't accept your petition"?
Well, Your Honor, under that different due process argument, I think there may be a valid argument to be made, but that is not the argument that...
Well, I agree with you that the constitutional argument is not made here. It troubles me that it's not made here, but it's not made here. But surely a habeas remedy wouldn't work for the hypothetical I just gave you.
I absolutely agree with you, Your Honor. Yes, a habeas
remedy. So there's got to be some limitations, as Justice Kuntz is suggesting. There's got to be some circumstance under which a court must consider a filing by a pro se defendant in a criminal case where the actual counsel of record has not acted. I can't imagine the system would countenance that.
Well, Your Honor, again, my response would be one that the court's already discussed 8.01-271.1 and how that envisions a pleading filed by either counsel or a party proceeding pro se. But the rules of this court follow a similar pattern. Rule, I believe it's 1.4c, which applies to both criminal and civil proceedings, states that counsel or an unrepresented party who files a pleading shall sign it and state his address. So,
but of course, the problem with that is that a statute trumps a rule.
That's right, Your Honor.
And so there's the dilemma with that argument, or what, that qualification.
What in the text of 801.271.1 prevented the trial court from considering a per se pleading? And specifically, the only thing I can see is if a paper is not signed, it has to be stricken. Well, this was signed. Now, it may have been signed improperly by the pro se, by a person acting who was represented by counsel. But isn't the overarching point of all of this, we want accountability? So if you're going to make a written assertion in a pleading in a court, with all the expense and heartache that entails, and it's frivolous or whatever, we're going to hold you accountable. And so we're going to ask you to formally sign it, and that signature means something. So the whole point is, I thought, accountability. So if he had made a frivolous motion or whatever, and he signed it, well then, okay, maybe that was improper, it should have been done through your counsel, but we don't strike that because it is signed, and also the purpose of the statute is satisfied because you signed it, and now we can hold you accountable. Am I missing something?
Well, Your Honor, the way I interpret the statute is it provides first, prior to that remedy avenue, it provides two different methods of signature. And the first, of course, is by counsel acting in his or her representative capacity. The second, other version, is through pro se, again, acting in his or her capacity. It does not envision a hybrid combination of the two. And I think in addition to just the statute, this court, for example, in Spencer versus Commonwealth, Now, granted, there the court was talking about a Faretta right and the ability of the defendant to proceed pro se, but the court also stated that if a defendant were permitted to act as co-counsel, such hybrid representation could promote a conflict over who controls tactical and trial decisions. And
would you agree with Justice McCullough's analysis that neither the statute nor Spencer really address these facts? The statute, and that it calls for an unsigned pleading, this one was signed, and recognizing that certainly the ability to help out at trial might be paramount to the ability to sign a pleading, but Spencer was looking at control of the courtroom, control of the trial. We don't want the defendant popping up, taking over for the lawyer who's there to represent him. So neither of them really address these facts.
I respectfully disagree to the extent that, again, because it essentially creates a slippery slope. What are we going to allow a representative party to file that we're not going to allow him or her to do at other times in litigation? Is it okay to file a post-conviction motion, or a bad example, is it okay to file a a motion to set aside? Is it okay to file a pretrial motion in limine if there's something that they disagree with? I think what most state courts and federal courts that have addressed the issue with respect to hybrid representation have held that it's not permissible because it muddies the waters and that the two rights are...
But most of them in practice just sort of hand a filed pleading to the attorney for the attorney to address it in trial or adopt it or whatever. It's not treated as if it doesn't exist, especially if it's, I understand your argument.
Thank you.
Well, it seems to me that implicit in your argument is it's not sufficient just to say the pleading was was signed, because the statute talks about two signing requirements. One is when they're represented by a lawyer, and one is when they're pro se.
Yes, sir.
And in each case, it indicates who has to sign it. So to say that it was signed is half of the question. The rest of the question is who signed it.
Yes.
And this, every pleading, written motion, other paper of a party represented by an attorney shall be assigned by at least one attorney of record in his individual name. Then it goes on to the second category. A party who is not represented by an attorney may sign it pro se, shall sign his pleading. And it seems to me that it's not sufficient just to say it was signed. This statute says who has to sign it.
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, it's a stronger argument on your behalf, it seems to me.
I apologize for inartfully making the argument, but that's exactly the point I was trying to raise, Your Honor, that it's essentially two different pathways, neither of which recognize a party proceeding in their own personal capacity who is simultaneously represented by counsel as signing any pleading.
May I ask you to shift gears for a moment? Why does the bad check law, 18.2.181, not apply to the third check? I mean, there's nothing in the language of the statute that incorporates this idea that if you sit on the check long enough, but yet you know at the time you sign it, it's obviously fraudulent, that the statute should be inapplicable. And, of course, we're talking only now about the third check, which arguably fits into that category.
Your Honor, I agree. I think that that there is nothing in the statute that prohibits a conviction based upon the fact pattern of a third check in this instance. I would agree that check does not constitute present consideration. And I think the argument, at least I don't want to put words into Mr. O'Gara's mouth, but I think he's alleging that because this was issued for past debt, it therefore does not qualify under the statute. Well, that term past debt is a term that has been used by the Court of Appeals in interpreting this statute. Certainly not a term that this court has adopted. And in fact, in Bray versus the Commonwealth, which is at least based upon my research, the case rather that is most similar to the third check, there the Court of Appeals affirmed a defendant's conviction for passing a bad check, which he used for a security deposit, for a prospective payment, for a residential property. And on appeal, Bray contended that she could not be convicted because that payment was not present consideration for goods or services as what she contended was required by the statute. The Court of Appeals disagreed and held that the gravamen of the offense of Code Section 18.2-181 is the intent to defraud, combined with passing the check.
The panel in this case was bound by those opinions, but we aren't, of course.
No, this Court certainly is not.
The statute is very literal. A person who with intent to defraud shall make, draw, utter, or deliver any check, knowing at the time of that it was not any good. It says nothing whatsoever of past, present, 3 months, 3 days, 3 hours.
Absolutely correct.
So if that doctrine is make weight, and it's in, we have to decide, if we were to bypass your procedural default, what the winning argument is. And implicit in the appellant's argument is that we decide that this past debt concept should be written into this otherwise literally clear statute. I'm not seeing it, and I don't see any argument that it should be the case. I see the cites to a 1990 Court of Appeals opinion, and if I were on a Court of Appeals panel, I'd be bound by it.
Right.
I'm not sure why I would give it much weight today.
Yes, Your Honor, and this Court has not addressed that issue squarely, and while also not binding on this Court.
So to reverse on the third check, we have to address it directly.
Yes.
For the first time, and embrace it.
Yes.
When we've been given two cites, which don't cite any of our cases.
Your Honor, to respond to your concern, my research of every single time this Court has mentioned this case, there's one case, Payne, where the Court considered the statutes on its merits, but that was prior to the amendment that added the third paragraph that dealt with present consideration for goods or services. The other times this Court has addressed the statute have had to deal with statute of limitations issues and other things, but this Court simply hasn't addressed the issue squarely, Your Honor, and that's why the Commonwealth cited those cases on brief.
Well, Counsel, what is the effect of the amendment? Why do we have it in the statute at all?
Your Honor, it's in the statute because in 1977 this Court issued its opinion in Lund versus Commonwealth that held that at common law, intangible goods, services, labor cannot be the subject of the crime of larceny because they cannot be taken and carried away. So 1 year later, in 1978, the General Assembly amended many larceny statutes to include 18.2-181, and there they included that third paragraph.
Well, what does present consideration have to do with any of that?
It doesn't, Your Honor, other than the fact that the General Assembly included it.
Well, are we supposed to just ignore that?
I don't think the Court can, simply because it's included in
it. Well, if we can't ignore it, what's it mean?
Well, Your Honor, I think it means exactly as it says, that any person who draws a check has present consideration for goods or services that simply did not intend to make that.
Well, how is it present consideration for a check that's given on May the 15th for an event which occurred in February or March?
Your Honor, I want to be clear. The Commonwealth is not contending that third check was present consideration for a good or service. What the Commonwealth is contending, again, Bray is the best that we could cite to this Court, is that third check situation is very similar to the case in Bray, which involved a prospective payment, where there, again, the defendant argued that she could not be convicted because the check was not for present consideration for goods or services. And what the Court held there was that third paragraph, that amendment to Code Section 18.2-181.
Well, what brings these checks under the facts of this case is because it was for goods and services. Isn't that correct?
Well, Your Honor, the third paragraph, yes, does address goods and services, but the first...
So if that's how you get under the statute, then what do you do with current?
Well, Your Honor, again, if the Court would permit
Absolutely.
Me simply just to respond, is that, again, that third paragraph did not alter the substance of the first paragraph of the statute, which still permits a conviction for passing a bad check with the intent to defraud combined with actually uttering a check that you know has insufficient funds.
I guess what troubles me is it sounds like you're saying that there's no meaning at all for the terms current consideration in the statute.
Your Honor, that's not at all what I'm trying to say. I'm simply making an argument, again, consistent with Bray, that held that third paragraph did nothing to amend that first paragraph, which still makes it the crime of passing a bad check simply by having the intent to defraud and passing a check on an account that someone knows they're insufficient funds for.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes, Your Honor.
Although we're getting a little bit far afield, but in the instance where there is no present good of service being returned, what is the intent to defraud in giving the check? Say, for instance, like the third check here, what was the person defrauded of debt was already owed?
I think that gets to the definition of intent to defraud, which includes essentially inducing someone else to alter their right or responsibility or obligation to their property. And in this case, that third check was offered to essentially further stall the hotel from obtaining property that it deserved under its contractual relationship with Mr. McGinnis.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Justice Kuhn, since he answered your question.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You have just shy of 2 minutes for rebuttal.
To begin with the amendment to the bad check statute, our position would be that what it's done is basically created a carve-out for past debts. The General Assembly does this in many other statutes. For example, I can think it's illegal for a violent felon to own or possess a stun gun unless he's in the curtilage of his own home. And we would argue that the amendment, the way to give it effect, is to just look at it as simply a carve-out, that for past debts, you know, we want you to have a bad intent when you pass the check to defraud someone. So if it's a past debt already, we're going to have a carve-out for this statute. If you want to, if another statute applies, that's fine, but not this one. And we would argue that whether that's a good idea or a bad idea, that is a quite reasonable thing to do in this case. And in interpreting the statute that way gives this court the ability to give meaning to the entire statute without running any problems. And certainly, before, when we were speaking about whether 8.01 is a civil statute or not, perhaps I did not express myself well. But I do mean to suggest that if this court were to find that statute only applies to civil cases, it would certainly not run into the constitutional due process issues that it does if it's applied uniformly over to all defendants in criminal cases. And I do think, kind of finally, that it's instructive when the Commonwealth was asked in the scenario, what is a defendant's, what can they do in this situation on day 20 or day 21? And his response was he could file a motion to fire his attorney. But the problem is that under a strict construction of this statute, that motion would be invalid because it's not signed by his attorney. The motion presupposes that he's represented because he's trying to fire him, and a strict construction would say, since it's not filed by that attorney, that motion is completely ineffective. So really, the suggested remedy by the Commonwealth is barred by the statute they want the court to uphold. And I would ask the court not to do that.
Thank you very much. The court will be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.
All rise.